You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Good Friday morning to you. Mike McNamara for a Friday edition of All Marine Radio right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Hold on, listen to this.
That ball's drilled to left field. It sends Gardner back at the wall. It's gone. A three-run shot from George Springer, and the Yankees fall behind 3-1. He's not had many hits in this postseason, but for George Springer, the ones that he has provided have been big ones.
Nice. In Yankee Stadium last night, the Yankees up 1-0 and needing to win that game to have a chance. George Springer, pretty good. Houston's pretty good. And then there's a second one, right? Alex Correa, who's the shortstop of the Astros. He's been struggling, but the Yankees have got him out of his struggles. He hit a home run to win game two? Here it is, last night. Uh-oh. That's got to be good, right? That's got to be good. The go in to any stadium where they're going crazy and just make it quiet. Here's my problem though with the Yankees. It reminds me of the stupidity of us in Iraq and Afghanistan. So the Yankees. Right. Instead of going out and getting the starting pitching they need, did they sign relievers in the offseason? So was the deliberate plan, we have guys that can go 4 or 5 innings and then we're going to run our relief pitchers in? Well, you can't do that over the course of 7 games. And so, like, when it was discussed that, like, well, this is the way we'll do it, didn't somebody say, yo, that's not going to work? Just can't work. And it was really interesting on the broadcast last night. So, I mean, honestly, so the winning syllogism for the Yankees in this series with the Astros was you got to hold serve on the three games that Verlander and Cole don't pitch, right? And then you got to beat them once. You got in one of four starts between Verlander and Cole, you got to beat them once. Okay, and I'll tell you, I mean, Cole's 19-0. Like, he went by some, like, if you don't know baseball history, but his name is like Nap LaJoy. Right, he pitched in like 1912. He won like, I don't know how many games. What Cole has done is unprecedented. So you're going to beat that guy? Probably not. Okay. And Verlander, right? He's, you know, he's been lights out, right? Now, he got beat by Tampa on short rest, but he's not pitching on short rest. So, I just don't understand. So you're watching it, and you're going, okay, this is how you set it up. So, anyway, the only comeback to that is, and again, my point is this. And I'll tell you what, I've watched this now. It's kind of interesting little sports link, right, to current events. But I watched it as I watched the 49ers. The 49ers changed their whole team by changing their defensive line. Do you remember the old Chicago Bears, right, with William Refrigerator Perry? And who was the guy named? The guy named Dent? Richard Dent, right? Mike Singletary, all those guys. Well, those guys, they allowed you no time. They dominated the line of scrimmage, and you weren't going to score many points. So the defensive backs didn't seem to be as good. Didn't need to be as good because you didn't have to cover for as long because those guys were going to get to the quarterback. And everybody knew it, you know? And remember, Jim McMahon wasn't even he's not a great quarterback. But he's Super Bowl champion. Yeah, Chicago Bears, Buddy Ryan, and all that kind of stuff. Remember them doing the Super Bowl shuffle on MTV? Yeah, that all came. So to me, I'm like the blueprint, right, for a football team, in my opinion, starts with the defensive line, right? Now, you could do it a different way if you wanted to start it with the offensive line. But to me, the thing that makes the most sense, because even your investments on the offensive side of the ball don't have to be as great if you're not giving up but 10 or less points a game because you're just dominant. And it starts with you cannot be a dominant football team without dominating the line of scrimmage. And I don't mean just winning. I mean dominating it. And if you watch the 49ers now, they got that kid from Ohio State, Nick Bosa, right? I mean, they've got like four or five first-round draft choices that play in their defensive line, completely transform their team. You look at the two teams that will go to the World Series. I mean, I don't know that I've seen starting pitching like this, but, I mean, look, it's not going to be any secret. The two teams with the best starting pitching go to the World Series. And so, to me, it's a head-scratcher like what the Yankees did. And, look, you can fake it in the regular season, but the postseason you can't win. It was interesting. We listened to Alex Rodriguez, David Ortiz, and Frank Thomas after the game last night. They got after the data geeks that do the analytics for baseball, talking about you can't just move people throughout the lineup all over the place. You know, this is a job. Part of it's confidence. Part of it's knowing what you do. Right, and these guys that sit up in the office and they crunch numbers and they come up with these lineups and statistics, real human beings go down and do that stuff, right? And uncertainty doesn't sit well with them, and they got into it. So anyway, but again, I didn't. The two best teams of baseball are Houston and Washington because of their starting pitching. And the Dodgers are like the Yankees a bit. They don't have the starting pitching. They have a lot of players, but they don't have the starting pitching they're not there. So World Series is going to be great. And somebody sent me a text message last night. You know, they could still do it, but like, look, the little engine that could, that's a fairy tale, okay? That isn't real. Now, I've seen miracles. The 86 World Series, one of them, where it seems to be there's divine intervention. Okay? Divine intervention. But that is not the way the world spins. Sometimes it happens, agreed, but it's not the way the world spins. So to me, where I general manager baseball, it starts with starting pitching. Right? And if you have good starting pitching and you have a good bullpen, then you don't need all stars at every position. You need guys who can hit and guys who can drive in runs, but you don't need nine of those guys. Maybe five or six. You know? But you gotta be dominant on the mound. I just don't get what the Yankees did. Anyway, so that's on my mind. The other thing, new reports, fighting in Syria. Nobody thought that would continue. Vice President Pence was over there. What? And I want to read to you, let's see, General Vogel was in the news, and he was speaking out. So give me one second. So he was speaking out about the news, and I can't even read this, so. It's like in size 2 font. What the fuck? Hold on, let me see if I can find it. Vogel. But he was talking about, the headline is another former CENTCOM. General weighs in with displeasure over Trump's gambit. And then I want to share with you comments that General Mattis made last night, in a speech. Now you probably saw the headline or a little snippet of it. The whole speech, honestly, is a great speech. Is a great speech about what this country needs. Vogel is the former leader of Central Command, most recent leader of Central Command, right? And has been publicly vocal about what he sees as a betrayal of the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces. Vogel, who co-authored a detailed piece in The Atlantic, told me that he was disappointed in this policy decision, and that there was not a lot of work undertaken to avoid a decision like this. The SDF have been exceptional partners, and we would not have been successful in ISIS against ISIS in Syria without them. They absorbed nearly 11,000 casualties in that fight. I am concerned what this might mean for future partnerships. Earlier this week, another former CENTCOM general officer sat down with me to talk about his concerns. Those concerns are deep and they are troubling, and they come from a man who, like all the others I have spoken with, is not a social justice warrior or a never-Trumper type. What we are seeing in Syria is probably one of the poorest, most uninformed, even arrogant policy decisions I've seen by any administration in the last 30 years, and specifically involving this region of the world, who spoke under a condition of anonymity. This one seems so arbitrary, so capricious, so uninformed. The retired general officer blamed it on Trump, dismissing advice and relying instead on his gut instinct. You know, how terrifying is that? A guy that doesn't have any, a novice relying on their gut instinct. Oh, shit. The series of precision strikes on sites we believed held chemical weapons on it, the airfield with Russian citizens present, was not something the previous administration would even consider, he said, but it stopped the use of chemical weapons. The SDF was doing an incredible job as an economy of force on behalf of the coalition. First in the destruction of ISIS and then actually in control So they made it so you didn't have to intervene against ISIS. And that there would be no ISIS resurrection. We have lost the ability to do that. Who in the region is going to ensure that we don't have a return of ISIS? Do you think the Kurds will do that on their own? I think we've lost them, and I think in doing so, we may have given an opening to ISIS or some other radical Sunni violent extremist element to raise its head. There's another issue, too, the retired general officer said. It's the moral part, he said. This is not the first time or the second time we've abandoned the Kurds, he said. It is at least the third time that we have walked away from the Kurds as an ally in the region. I think it will be many generations before anyone is willing to trust an American in uniform there. We said, I'm here to protect you, and we should fight together. That's the most painful piece to me. To his former Kurdish counterparts, he offered this. The first words out of my mouth would be a pretty humble apology, he said. Like any good American, you want to leave the people you're fighting with something uplifting. Carry on. But how do you do that when you know you're going to stand them up against a massive military force like Turkey? And that comes out of the observation post. So General Vodal in the news this week. So, ceasefire yesterday, you know, the vice president there. Again, ceasefires, they don't mean anything in that part of the world, right? And nobody, ceasefires are an opportunity to rearrange your forces, to get the wounded moved, to resupply with ammunition, right? And if they're stupid enough to allow ambulances to move around the battlefield, then, you use those ambulances to move weapons, ammunition, and all the rest of that. So, yeah, that's what ceasefires are for, right? So just so you know, don't be stupid about it. Life's tough. It's tougher when you're stupid. So what will become of it? Good question. Good question. I want to play some audio from General Mattis. General Mattis, he's in the news for, right, taking a shot at the president. So he is at the Al Newman dinner. No, Al Smith dinner. So what's the Al Smith dinner? Right? It is the dinner for the Alfred E. Smith Memorial Foundation, commonly known as the Al Smith dinner. It's a white tie dinner in New York City to raise funds for Catholic charities supporting children of various needs in the Archdiocese of New York. So that's where he was last night. And so I want to play the audio from it. So the first part is hilarious, and then he gets serious, right? So, you'll only, you know, in most of the stories, all they talk about is like his jab at Donald Trump. But he jabs at a few people, all right? And it's pretty funny. And so, but then he goes on to deliver serious remarks about the future of the democracy, this experiment in democracy, and where we are at with it. So it's a great speech. I mean, he's a great speaker, obviously.
I do stand before you, as was noted here, having achieved greatness. I mean, I'm not just an overrated general. I am the greatest, the world's most overrated. And this is in no small part. I will tell you, I owe New York. I owe New York for this because Senator Schumer, have I thanked you for bringing my name up in a rather contentious meeting in Washington where this grew out of. So I would just tell you, too, that I'm honored to be considered that by Donald Trump, because he also called Meryl Streep an overrated actress. So I guess I'm the Meryl Streep of generals. And frankly, that sounds pretty good to me. And you do have to admit that between me and Meryl, at least we've had some victories. And some of you were kind during the reception and asked me, you know, if this bothered me to have been rated this way based on what Donald Trump said. I said, of course not. I earned my spurs on the battlefield, Martin, as you pointed out, and Donald Trump earned his spurs in a letter from a doctor. So not in the least bit put out by it. And I think the only person in the military that Mr. Trump doesn't think is overrated is who you pointed out, Martin, and that's Colonel Sanders. But none of this can diminish the honor that I feel tonight.
Whoa, how about that, huh? All right. But it gets better, though. Listen to this.
Being here among all of you wonderful folks in this great all-American city, I, too, Mary Ann, was thinking of my parents as I was coming in tonight. They were married just a couple blocks away in 1946 in a small chapel in St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I have no doubt, believe me, ladies and gentlemen, no doubt that they would be surprised as I was when I received the Cardinal's phone call to come here and speak at this august event. If you told my parents 46 years ago, considering they would have been entitled to drown me at birth had they known how many gray hairs I was going to give them, if you had told them that I was going to be speaking to a room full of clergy, including the Cardinal, their first question would have been, so what did he do? Followed shortly by, 10 Hail Marys are not sufficient, throw the book at him. But I grew up out in the West, they moved West, and we don't get dressed up like this out there very often. To be honest with you, the last time I wore this outfit was for a public cremation. True story. And I assured Mary when I sat down next to her that I had had the suit cleaned since that time. I'm used to wearing a uniform, as many of you know. I was served in the U.S. Marines. I'm very proud of that service. I commanded forces. Thank you. I commanded forces, as Martin pointed out, in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan. I tried to bring some peace and order to places with no organized government, chaotic and warring factions, irrational fears, and toxic hatred. It was hard work, but it wasn't until I started working in Washington, D.C., that I realized how easy I had it overseas in a combat zone. Now, this won't be news to anyone in this room, but we're going through a tough, highly partisan time here in our country. And I've never been much for partisanship. I've always believed in bipartisanship, and the greatness of our country lies in teamwork. And my record on bipartisanship is clear. After all, I've reportedly been fired by presidents of both parties. I will stand on that record. As many of you know, Donald Trump nicknamed me Mad Dog. But these days, I've turned over a kinder, gentler leaf. And I like to think of myself as less of a mad dog and more of an emotional support animal. And that's really great, because now the airlines let me fly for free.
Is that awesome or what? Yeah, most of them play like the 90 seconds of him getting after Trump. The whole speech is funny, and then he takes it on a serious note.
But Cardinal Dolan, I am grateful you invited me here. Your Eminence, after some of my public remarks, I don't get invited to speak in front of polite company anymore. So I think my presence here is probably proof of the Cardinal's generosity of spirit and the boundless forgiveness of God that I could be here with you tonight. It's been a year since I left the administration. The recovery process is going well. The counselor says I'll graduate soon. A year is, according to White House time, about 9,000 hours of executive time or 1,800 holes of golf. And that's given me some time to reflect and to think about what our country and where it's going And that's what I want to talk about tonight. I wanted to reflect on the legacy of Al Smith, showing affection to the children as they are helped into adulthood in what remains the greatest country, most promising country, most wonderful country on earth, and our responsibility to that generation. As I studied Al Smith, I had to look him up and learn more about him. I found what we find in many great leaders, Abe Lincoln, FDR. It's a focus on making our country a little better when we hand it to the next generation and having a nonpartisan approach to team building. Your Eminence, when we spoke on the phone, you noted that we meet in the spirit here tonight of unity and friendship, patriotism. And so I turn to history, for we've been through tough times in the past in our country, and often in history, I have found the way forward. It's tempting this evening to look back exactly a century to 1919, the year that Alfred Emanuel Smith first took office as governor of New York. His nomination as the Democratic Party's candidate for president, the first Roman Catholic to be nominated for that office by a major party, still lay 9 years ahead. It was in many ways a troubled time. Anti-immigrant fervor ran high. Political corruption made national headlines. The glitz of the jazz age was real, yet working and living conditions for much of the American population were abysmal. The country was enjoying an economic boom, but a storm was on the horizon. So there's a certain resonance here with today. Tonight I'd like to recede even further into history, to 1838 into Springfield, Illinois. There, an organization in Springfield called the Young Men's Lyceum, which Abraham Lincoln's friend, William Herndon, once described as a society which contained and commanded all the culture of that place. Sort of like this gathering here this evening, except it didn't have the ladies who were the better half. That month was January, and Lincoln himself was just shy of 29. Violence by supporters of slavery had shattered the state and the nation. Now at the Young Men's Lyceum, Lincoln rose to give an address called The Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions. Not the catchiest of titles, but it defined the very thing that was under threat. It's a long speech, by my reckoning, enough for 12 Al Smith dinners. And there weren't any jokes. But the core of its message can be simply stated. After extolling the wisdom of the founders and of our constitutional system, Lincoln observed great nations crumble for one of two reasons. The first is aggression from the outside, a prospect Lincoln declared that in America's case was inconceivable. As he put it with a flourish of memorable cadences, all the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined with all the treasure of the earth in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track over the Blue Ridge Mountains in a trial of 1,000 years. No, Lincoln went on, it was not the foreign aggressor we must fear. It was corrosion from within, the rot, the viciousness, the lassitude, the ignorance. Anarchy is one potential consequence of all this. Another is the rise of an ambitious leader, unfettered by conscience or precedent or decency, who would make himself supreme. If destruction be our lot, Lincoln warned, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. I think often of Abraham Lincoln's Lyceum speech because it embodies both our greatest hopes and our darkest fears. Today, in our own time, we need only look around us. For decades, our political conduct has been woeful and a source of national paralysis. We have supplanted trust and empathy with suspicion and contempt. We have scorched our opponents with language that precludes compromise. We have brushed aside the possibility the person with whom we disagree might actually sometimes be right. We proclaim what divides us and seldom even acknowledge what unites us. Meanwhile, the roster of urgent national issues have continued to grow, unaddressed and given the paralysis impossible to address, and all of this was approaching a level of crisis even before the specter of impeachment arose. This is the moment for an act of remembrance, remembrance of the core principles we used to know and live by, and that we now seem to have forgotten. We seem to have forgotten that America is not some finished work, nor is it a failed project. Rather, it's an ongoing experiment for which all of us bear responsibility, including a responsibility to repair. We seem to have forgotten that the foundational virtue of democracy is trust.
Now, if you're just tuning in, this is General Mattis. He gave a speech at the Alfred E. Smith dinner last night in New York, sponsored by the Catholic Archdiocese of New York City, and raises money for the Catholic charities in and around New York City. And so you've seen, you know, the jab he takes at the president. But what you didn't see or hear is the eloquent speech that he gave subsequent to that.
Not trust in one's own rectitude or opinion, but trust in the capacity of collective deliberation to move us forward. We seem to have forgotten that cynicism, which has now infected the Western democracies, is not realism for all the weary and knowing errors it affects. Cynicism is just cowardice. It is nothing less than a form of surrender. And finally, we seem to have forgotten, too, the paramount importance of those bonds of affection that Lincoln once spoke of. We need one another more than ever when the chips are down. Historically, we have come together in those moments after the attack on Pearl Harbor, after the 9/11 attack on this very city. The surest path to catastrophe is to ignore our better angels and sever those bonds of affection. As you know, it was my privilege over a period of 4 decades to wear the uniform of the Marines, and I can tell you it's a much more comfortable uniform than the one I'm wearing tonight. But this evening, I would like to also share 2 stories from my time in uniform. One is a reminder of the importance of keeping things in perspective, especially in difficult times. The other, a reminder to see ourselves sometimes as others do, because what they see sometimes doesn't show up in our own mirrors. The first story comes from April of 2004 in Iraq, outside a city where insurgents had taken control. My forces were poised to take it back. The night before the assault, probably around 1 o'clock in the morning, I had spoken to the assault troops as they prepared for battle, and it was now time for generals to get out of the way and leave it to the young men. Afterwards, when one Marine thought I was out of earshot, I heard him ask his squad leader, "Do you think it's going to be tough?" And the squad leader replied in a corporal's vernacular that I won't quote verbatim, but he said, "Hush and get some rest. We took Iwo Jima. Fallujah won't be nothing." I think of those words as I look at the responsibilities that we Americans must shoulder now, shoulder today. We have succeeded against greater odds. We wring our hands about the condition of the country, yet we're not facing the Civil War or the Great Depression. It is hard work to make our democracy work, and indeed our Constitution was designed to make it hard. But hard it might be, it is also noble work, for we're building a country here. And my second story also comes from Iraq. One day we apprehended an insurgent in the act of planting a mine on a major road. In fact, it was a road I'd just driven on. Now a prisoner, bound hand and foot, the Marines brought him to me because they were surprised to find that he spoke English. He and I talked for a bit, and I made clear he was lucky to be alive and that he had an orange jumpsuit in his future. He was, no two ways about it, the enemy, at least when he was doing his day job or his night job. America, in his mind, was the great Satan. But before he was loaded onto a truck to be taken off to confinement, he said, "General, can I ask you something?" And so I stopped and waited for him. He said, "If I behave myself, if I'm a model prisoner, is there a chance that my family and I can immigrate to America?" Now think about that. I wasn't going to sponsor him, but his words offered a reminder to me. His words reminded me how America is still viewed in the world. Even among those who profess to hate it, America remains a power of inspiration in their lives as well. They see our freedoms and our vitality, our long tradition of democratic government, our chaotic and exuberant culture, and they want in. I often wish that we Americans could see ourselves through foreign eyes. It would remind us of our great good fortune and of the good things that we have in common, the good things we too often take for granted. Would remind us, too, of the precious deposit of freedom and the faith in our founding principles that have been passed up to now from generation to generation. That is what the 29-year-old Abraham Lincoln wanted to remind his own audience at the Young Men's Lyceum. And he called on his listeners to renew their commitment. He said, "Let every American, every lover of liberty, every well-wisher to his prosperity, swear by the blood of the Revolution never to violate in the least particular the laws of the country and never to tolerate their violation by others." In 1782, in Alexander Hamilton's last letter to his comrade in arms, Lieutenant Colonel John Lawrence, he wrote, "We have fought side by side to make America free. Let us hand in hand struggle to make her happy." Now, Lawrence died in one of the last skirmishes of our long, seemingly endless war for independence, never seeing the happy country for which he gave his life. We owe him a debt, as we owe a debt to all who have fought for liberty, including those who tonight serve in the far corners of our planet, among them the American men and women supporting our Kurdish allies. And I would note that the phrase, "all who have fought for liberty," also includes the generations of ordinary citizens who have embodied our national ideals and passed them down. In Springfield, Lincoln invoked biblical language to describe how the power of this common spirit protects our nation. He said, "As truly as has been said of the only greater institution, Your Eminence, the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." So, ladies and gentlemen, with malice for none and charity for all, let us restore trust in one another. Thank you very much.
How about that? You know what? I would tell you that that's the single most significant task that sets in front of the nation, and that is to remove the malice that exists in our political dialogue, right, and to restore the ability to compromise to politics. That is the single most significant job in front of the nation today. And I'll tell you what, an incredible advocate and our incredible spokesman for that cause is he. So, General J.N. Mattis. His full remarks last night, way better than his little jab at the President of the United States. All right, we need to open the program. So Whitney Houston makes it official. Good morning to you.
Ooh.
this is dedicated to Jim Mattis from the state of Washington. He used to be in the Marine Corps, and now he's not. But that was a great speech. That was a great speech. Too bad most of the nation will only hear, you know, the sliver of it that doubles for clickbait. But for those of us who understand what substance is, and let me read you an email from Nancy, entitled Mattis. Thanks, Mac. I love this so much. Fitness Friday for sure. He talks about, though, and essentially calls out political cynicism is cowardice. How about that? All you politicians out there. Your inability, right, to compromise, to seek the middle ground, is cowardice. And the nation needs you all to stop being cowards. Yeah. So this is dedicated to Jim Mattis. Nice going, bruh.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
If you don't love your Marines, then you really ought to get out. The only reason I stuck around that low paying outfit 40 years is for the absolute pleasure of serving alongside cocky, rambunctious, disciplined, selfless, unbelievably selfless young Marines. And the infantry got its name, young soldier. And I enjoyed being around them. And in the military, it's all about the team. And so if you don't know the team players beyond simply their rank and last name, you don't care about them deeply. I mean, just go up to Bethesda anytime you want to see the cost of war and see the ranks on the rooms. that you're walking into. Lance Corporal here, Lance Corporal there, CFC here, Sergeant there, Lieutenant. If you don't care about these guys, don't expect them to care about what's important to you. They're putting their lives on the line.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, you know, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once them bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
All right, we'll check the weather here on a Friday. Currently, it is partly sunny and 59 in Quantico. I get to buy a coat. You know, my favorite coat, I had this toggle coat that I bought when I was living in North Dakota. It was the best. It was the warmest coat. And I left it last spring in the airport in Phoenix because I was so excited after I was coming back from doing post-traumatic winning for the first time. I was in this euphoric state because of the impact that it had. And I was on the phone with somebody, and I put my coat down, and then they started boarding the plane. I picked up my pack, and I walked away from my favorite coat. So now I've got to replace it. And it's not easy, man. It's called a toggle coat or a duffel coat. Got a hood on it, navy blue. Comes down to just above the knee, you know, probably a little bit like low thigh area. Yeah. So when it's cold, yeah, you don't get cold, man. When a coat covers your ass, that's good to go. Anyway, it's getting cool. In another 2 weeks, it'll be even cooler where I'm going. Colorado, D.C., and Minnesota. Yeah. Anyway, so partly sunny at 59 in Quantico. Sunny at 62 at Camp Lejeune. Sunny at 63 at 29 Palms. Sun and 58 at Camp Pendleton, dark cloudy and 73 Camp Smith, dark clear in Okinawa and 77 in Ramadi. It's early evening, 89 degrees under cloudy skies. In Lashkar Gah in Helmand in Afghanistan, it is clear. Early evening and 67. At the home of All Marine Radio, partly cloudy and 63. Your shithole weather updates, right? From Webster, Mass, right? 47 degrees, and that's as good as it's going to get today. Winds 15 miles an hour with gusts of 24. That means it's going to be cold. Cold and blustery. Not sure what blustery means, but I've heard it all my life, so it must be legit. Have a good weekend. Chris from Webster out. And Chris is actually pretty funny. The, let's see. Nancy Dunham. Pleasantville, Pennsylvania. The vacation destination for Erie, PA. Didn't know that. Currently mostly cloudy and 42 degrees. Headed for a high of 52. Winds out of the northwest at 7 miles an hour. So that is a look at your weather. We'll take a quick break. We'll check a few news headlines, and then Mary Reinwald is supposed to join me. And Mary is a retired colonel. She is the editor of Leatherneck magazine, right? So she's the editor of Leatherneck. She sat on the Hewley panel in 2016 that reviewed all the different all the different bodies of evidence that was used in reviewing and validating that John Bradley was not in the second flag raising. Okay, so we're going to have her on. I have to find out what I did with what I read yesterday. I don't know what the hell I did with it. But so Mary Reinwald's going to join us. And so we'll talk to her in about, I don't know, in the next 15 minutes. So Mary Reinwald going to join us. So it's pretty interesting. Again, Marine Corps re-identifies a second flag raiser 74 years later in the most famous picture that comes out of World War II that's as identified. Again, General Mattis just told a story about a young Marine looking at his squad leader and saying, "Do you think it's going to be rough?" And the Marine said, the corporal said, "We took fucking Iwo Jima, man. Fallujah's not going to be shit." And General Mattis cleaned it up, though, for the Alfred E. Smith dinner. But that's how deeply that battle, that image, is soaked into our tradition, our history as a Marine Corps. So anyway, and yet, again, we identify somebody who was in the picture, which now the story of the picture is completely different, right? And so I'll talk to Mary about that. And I see Bradley as a victim. I see Gagnon as an opportunist, whether that's right or wrong. And again, Gagnon is a veteran, a proud veteran of that battle, right? But, you know, again, you know, we all have to live with the things we do. And Gagnon is the one who initially points out who's in the picture. And he says he's in the picture. And now history confirms he is not in the picture. I read a sad article yesterday that his son, who's still alive, lives in, I think, Concord, Massachusetts. I believe that's where he lives. He talks about how disillusioned he was because his father knew he wasn't. He says his father knew he wasn't in the picture. Right? He had to have known. Now, not that his father ever told that to him, because he didn't. But now he says, look, the forensic evidence, you know, right? He wasn't in the picture. And Rene Gagnon Jr., right, he's retired now. He put vinyl siding on houses. You know, that's what he did for a career. And so, yeah, it's a sad article that you read about, very disillusioned. This thing that has been such a huge force in his life, he now comes to learn that it's a fraud, right? It's a fraud. And he had taken James Bradley to task that, you know, Bradley had written a book that had done damage to his father's reputation. And Bradley, it turns out, wasn't even in the picture. And now it turns out that neither one of them were in the picture. So two sons of the only, again, the only two people in the flag raising that had sons, right, that had children, except we didn't know that Corporal Harold, nicknamed Pie, last name Keller, born in Iowa, right? He had three kids. And so anyway, it's an amazing story, honestly. It's an amazing story. So we'll talk to Mary Reinwald about that when we have her on. The top five stories in Early Bird. Yeah, Bob Nielsen's one that turned me on to the now, see, Bob, to say Bob is not a fan of the president isn't doing that justice. So he reacts to, I think, unless, because he said, and again, he sent me a message early this morning and said, you know, something about Trump and Mattis. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Now, I would be surprised if he listened to the whole speech. Right? So I'll find out if he listens to the whole speech. But the little, you can see from the speech, it's a speech of substance. It's a speech of this cynicism and this hatred that permeates the political dialogue of this nation. Is crippling the nation in terms of the ability to compromise, the ability to say that somebody from the other party has a good idea. And we need to join with them to pass this because that's what's in the best interest of the nation, right? That's what's in the best interest of the nation. So, I'll find out. Let's see. Top five stories in Early Bird are as follows. I'm just making sure that I'm not missing anything today. All right. Number one, ISIS will be back. Lawmakers voice Syria fears to Pentagon chiefs. House and Senate lawmakers on Thursday left Pentagon briefings on the crisis in Syria frustrated with the tangle of problems that came with President Donald Trump's decision to pull troops out of Syria and voicing new fears the Islamic State will regroup and wage terror. Number two, Syria ceasefire in question after fighting shelling reports. Look, there will be no ceasefire, okay? Americans are the only one that live by the Marcus Queensberry rules, right? Everybody else just uses those things, right, to reposition and all the rest of that stuff. Number three, another Marine was misidentified in iconic Iwo Jima flag-raising photo, according to the Marine Corps. Number four, Trump blasts Mattis as the most overrated general. Now, according to Mattis, that came out of that meeting they had in the White House where Schumer quotes Mattis to tell Trump, you're wrong, right? And then Trump blasts Mattis. In the speech you just listened to, Mattis thanks Schumer for doing that. Thanks for getting me blasted. Number five, what the Army is doing to fix housing problems and set up a tenant bill of rights. Again, this is a story that we followed. It got a lot of media attention, right? Months ago, then the steam went out of the balloon and the housing firms, right, have banded together to push back on whatever reform measures are being put in place, right? I've heard rumors that the housing, you know, those houses are not fully occupied, which means the companies aren't being paid the rent that they need to make the contract work and that they're in danger of not being able to make it work, which would be interesting. I don't know what to believe, okay? Syria-Turkey headlines, and then we'll take a break. Erdo, an advisor, says Trump's letter was not taken seriously at the time. A senior advisor to Turkish President Erdogan on Thursday said President Trump's recently released letter to the NATO ally was, quote, not taken seriously at the time due to the way it was worded, calling it absolutely irrelevant. There you go. Next headline. Amid a hasty withdrawal, Pentagon scrambles to revise campaign against the Islamic State. Next headline. Pompeo scrambles to reassure Israel over Syria withdrawal. Okay, just know this. Like, everybody can dance, right? Right? When Jerusalem acts, right? When Jerusalem acts to deal with the instability in the region, they won't fuck around. And then we'll be drawn back into that son of a bitch. And nobody's going to say, yeah, whatever. Turkish proxies appear to be using white phosphorus in Syria. Uh-oh. Hey, I will tell you this. I just want to commend the United States Army for, you see that at their AUSA, their Army USA thing that they have going on in Washington, D.C. this week. You see them in their old style, what they called pink and greens, but gabardine, kind of tan gabardine slacks and that dark tunic they wore in World War II. That, my friends, is a great looking uniform. All right, we'll take a break. Joining us next is Mary Reinwald, and then the chef will join us after that. So whatever you do, be smart. Do not touch that dial. Because Mary Reinwald's smart, and she sat on the Huley board. So we'll talk to her about this. And again, the Huley board set in motion, right, events that allowed this identification to happen. Okay, so it's interesting stuff. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.